claws were clinging to the wall 20 meters behind him, which meant above him, since he was descending the grav tube face first. He rolled onto his back, then felt more impacts as two more projectiles burrowed into his titanium breastplate. Still wasn't a disaster, but getting closer. A line of the Saurian aliens was hanging above the closed hatch, each clinging to a built-in utility ladder with one hand and firing some sort of Covenant carbine with the other. Sooner or later, one of them was bound to hit a soft spot in his armor, just as they had Sam's. John raised his MA-5K and emptied the magazine, running a line of fire straight up their column. His rounds deflected off some kind of personal energy barrier, ricocheting around the grav tube and coming back at the alien's flanks and deflecting again. The energy shield seemed to flicker out after multiple hits, but these guys were clearly elite warriors who knew how to maintain fire. When a lucky ricochet finally caught one of them in the throat, the four survivors stepped away from the ladder and began to descend after John and Kelly. Still standing upright, they arranged themselves into a circle and began to fire down through the center of their formation. Kelly opened up, squeezing off targeted three-round bursts. She caught one of the aliens under the mandibles and filled his helmet with gore. John ejected his ammo clip and reached for another, enemy rounds still impacting his armor, mostly glancing off, but some burying themselves deep in the titanium shell. A little deeper, and it would be a disaster. Above the enemy, the blast of a breaching charge launched the hatch itself into the grav tube. Fred and Linda stuck their helmets through the opening and poured targeted fire from above. The head of one alien erupted into a purple spray. The surviving pair adjusted to the situation instantly, one raising his weapon to meet Fred and Linda's attack, the other continuing to lay fire on John and Kelly. A heartbeat later, John's stomach flipped, and the invisible force drawing them down the grav tube reversed direction and began to carry everyone, aliens included, back up toward the blown hatch. As the aliens rose past it, they stopped firing and pulled dark orbs from their belt pouches. John and Kelly both yelled, "Grenade!" over TeamCom. John slapped the new magazine into his MA-5K and opened fire, but the orbs had begun to glow with white flame, and the two aliens were already throwing. Fred and Linda spun away, and the grenades flew through the opening into the main passageway. In the next instant, the two Spartans reappeared, leaping into the grav tube feet first. They immediately raised their weapons and began spraying rounds at the enemy above them. The grenades detonated, a searing white brilliance pouring through the hatch and filling the shaft, and John lost sight of the pair. His own ascent slowed briefly as a concussion wave hammered him from above. Then he and Kelly were rising past the open hatch. The passageway beyond was lined with dead enemies, clustered in four groups, all armored and armed with Covenant carbines. They were facing all directions, a sign they had died surprised and confused. Beyond them, Gold Team was advancing down the passageway, Joshua and Daisy leading the way with M301 grenade launchers slung under their MA-5C assault rifles. The other two members were hanging back, ready to eliminate any more of the Covenant who made the mistake of thinking they could sneak up on a Spartan. Then John was past the hatch, still ascending the grav tube next to Kelly. The clatter of small arms fire above fell silent, and he looked up to find Fred changing his magazine while Linda continued to aim her BR-55 upward. The grav tube beyond was too littered with hatch doors and dead aliens to see what awaited Blue Team at the top of the shaft. But amazingly enough, it still appeared possible to capture this ship. John went back to TeamCom. "Gold Team, sit rep. Main deck under control," Joshua reported. "Eliminated maybe 200 targets. No casualties. How's your ammo holding up?" "About half down," Joshua said. "But Naomi has figured out those hingehead rifles. We'll be okay." Naomi was Naomi 010, one of the Spartans' more resourceful soldiers, and a near genius with any sort of equipment. By the age of 10, she had been a master armorer who was refining and modifying every infantry weapon the Spartans used, and currently she was the only one on the squad who seemed to completely understand the theory behind the Mjolnir's reactive circuits. But John had never heard of such a weapon designation. "Hinge head?" "The big ones with the four jaws," Joshua said. "The ones that know how to fight." The tall Saurians, in other words. Now designated elites, John said. Take gold team and lay below. Disrupt any counterattack preparations, especially those led by elites. Affirmative. Gold team moved out of motion tracker range and vanished from John's HUD. The clang of colliding metal drew his attention overhead, where a jumble of twisted hatch sections and dead elites were pinned against the top of the grav tube. To their left, on the side opposite the utility ladder, hung a single-width hatch, a vertical oval with a split down the center. A second utility ladder descended beneath it, each rung slightly offset so that it angled around the shaft wall to join the first. "Shouldn't that hatch be open by now?" Kelly asked. "If it's activated by proximity, all those dead elites, it's overridden." John reached over and caught hold of a ladder rung. "Grab!" The gravity field reversed polarity and jerked John downward, and the order came to an abrupt end. His arm straightened, and his elbow hyperextended and erupted in pain. He held on anyway, his Mjolnir armor's force-multiplying circuits droning as he fought the grav tube's pull. Fred and Linda dropped past and shot down the shaft, their outstretched gauntlets clanging off the ladder rungs as they tried to grab hold. Kelly was somewhere below them, already beyond motion tracker range. A new contact appeared on his HUD. John looked up and saw the hatch door splitting open, an armored hand reaching into the seam from either side. Both held dark orbs. Grenades. More grenades. John opened fire, raising his MA5K one-handed and running a burst up the widening seam. The first rounds were deflected by energy shields, but he managed to hit both grenades as they ignited in white flame and were released. He managed to send one tumbling back toward the enemy. The second fell to the deck, then rolled into the grav tube and was sucked down the shaft. "Incoming!" John warned over TeamCom. "Grin—" The detonations filled the tube with white heat, one blast boiling up the shaft from below and the other spraying through the half-open hatch above. John's HUD flashed to static, and the first blast wave ripped one side of the ladder from the wall. The second wave nearly impaled him on its broken rungs. John's grasp remained secure, even when the rung in his hand snapped on one side and bent downward. He jammed his boots onto the ladder, slapped his MA5K onto its magnetic mount, and began to climb the offset rungs, the few that remained, ascending toward the mangled wreckage of the hatch. "Blue team, report!" "Gel locked, but uninjured," Fred responded, "lying in the bottom of the grav tube. Should be operational once the pressure bleeds off." "Same as Fred," Linda said. "Condition good."
"Under them both."
Kelly's voice was thin with anguish.
"Also gel-locked. But I have torso pain and blood in my under armor. Must be a compound rib fracture."
John felt his gut clench. Compound rib fractures were dangerous, even for Spartans. With the jagged end of a bone moving around inside the chest cavity, something as simple as a deep breath could puncture a lung or lacerate the heart. "Copy," John said. "Fred, get her out of the grav tube. I don't want her getting slammed around anymore."
"I can take care of myself," Kelly said. "I don't need a babysitter.
And I don't need an argument. Clear?"
"Affirmative. But you're being overprotective."
By overprotective, John knew Kelly meant jerk. But if it kept his Spartans alive, John was okay with being an overprotective jerk. He was under the hatch now, and could hear the chattering of alien voices coming through the gap between its twisted halves. He poked his head up above the deck and glimpsed a relatively small oval compartment beyond, with a high dome overhead and a two-tiered bank of instrument consoles arranged in a semicircle around a central commander's throne. The consoles were manned by busy elites, most uniformed in white tabards striped by blue diagonals. But at least three armored elites were pointing alien carbines at the hatch, and when they saw John peering through the gap, they opened fire. Already ducking out of sight, John grabbed a pair of fragmentation grenades from his satchel and thumbed the arming sliders. "Hold fast, Blue Leader," Linda said over TeamCom. "I am unlocked and climbing. I'm with you in 60 seconds. 60 seconds was forever in a firefight, but with the hatch jammed open, John could probably hold his position that long. What he couldn't do was prevent the enemy from tossing more grenades into the grav tube. and that meant Linda's chances of getting blown up were about the same as her chances of reaching him alive. Negative. John brought his arm up and tossed his grenades through the half-open hatch. Vacate and support Green Team. I've got this. Alone? Linda asked. That's insane. You need support. The ladder shuddered with the double thump of the grenades detonating on the bridge, and a cone of flame and shrapnel shot from the half-open hatch and flashed across the tube above John's head. He was already drawing two more grenades from his belt satchel. The grav tube is a kill zone. John thumbed the arming sliders and tossed the grenades through the hatch, this time trying for a higher arc that would carry them toward the front of the bridge. Vacate! That's an order! Another pair of detonations shook the ladder. John poked his head up again and found the bridge littered with elites, some broken and dead, some still writhing in pain, all torn and bloody. Here and there, a slender Saurian head showed above an instrument panel, its beady eyes fixed on the hatch. In the center of the compartment sat the commander's throne, its back panel warped and blackened from a grenade detonation. On the right side, a jagged limb hung above an armrest filled with glowing toggles and glide switches. On the left side, a leathery forearm in singed cloth lay stretched along the armrest, a pair of long alien fingers scratching at a boxy yellow cover about half the size of a human palm. It looked like a safety cover. John reached into the opening, grabbed a hatch panel, then hauled himself onto the top rung of the utility ladder. The fingers on the commander's throne found what they were scratching for, and the yellow safety cover retracted into the armrest. A holographic keypad appeared in its place, and the fingers began to fly over glowing symbols. John drew his M6D sidearm and put a round through the elite's upper arm. The fingers touched another pair of symbols, and the keyboard vanished. A yellow blister, likely some kind of control button, rose out of the armrest. John put a second shot through the elbow, but the hand was already descending toward the blister. The round blew the elite's forearm half off and sprayed purple blood across half a dozen instrument consoles. But the alien retained adequate shoulder control to draw its arm back toward the chair. Its hand landed atop the yellow bubble, the heel of its palm coming down hard enough to punch it back down into the armrest. The ship did not self-destruct. Instead, the commander's hand remained atop the blister, and an ambient green light rippled through the bridge. A trio of hidden panels retracted into the outer bulkheads, revealing open iris hatches on the three forward sides of the bridge. Elite survivors began to rise from behind their instrument consoles and spring toward the hatches, obviously less afraid of John than of what their commander had just initiated. Bad mistake. The last thing Oni wanted was survivors providing first-hand accounts of the Spartan boarding action. John opened fire with his M6D, blowing holes through elite chests with 50-caliber nickel-plated rounds, and activated team comm. Green Team, sit rep. Assaulting the engineering deck now, Kurt-051 reported. We're going to take it, but it's too easy. Something's wrong. Like all hands abandoning ship? John asked. Not the drones, Kurt said. They're staying to fight. But everyone else, break off and get out now. John's M6D locked open as it ran out of ammunition. Gold and blue teams, you too. What happened? Linda asked. I can be on the bridge in 30 seconds, maybe less. We can still take the ship. John holstered his sidearm and thought about it, pulling the MA-5K off its magnetic mount. There were no aliens left to throw grenades down the grav tube, so it wasn't a kill zone any longer. But if he was right about that blister on the commander's armrest, he'd still be putting her at risk. For no reason. The bridge was already John's. All he had to do was walk in, secure the wounded, and make certain the commander's hand did not leave the blister. John muscled the hatch panels apart, and shoving the MA-5K through ahead of him, quickly checked the adjacent corners for ambushers. Seeing only pieces of dismembered elites, he stepped onto the bridge and finally replied. Negative, Linda. John switched to squad comm so that Halima Ascot and the rest of the Prowler squadron would hear his report. The alien commander has his hand on what looks like a dead man's switch. I think he's trying to give his crew a chance to abandon ship before he self-destructs. That's supported by what we're seeing from our position, Ascot replied. There are escape capsules dropping everywhere. I think I can secure the switch, John said, but I want the rest of the assault squad off the ship just in case. Affirmative, Ascot said. The squadron is already moving to sync orbits. We heard. John did not elaborate on the trouble the sensor operator's mistake had caused his Spartans. That would come later, during the debrief, and if he had anything to say about it, right before the court-martial. Team leaders, let me know when you're clear. Green team clearing now, Kurt reported. Once clear of the ship, the Spartans would drop into a pre-assigned orbit and await pickup by a prowler. Rebreathers recharged to 70%. Beacons on. Gold team right behind him, Joshua said. Rebreathers recharged to 75%. Beacons on. Blue 2 and 3 commandeering enemy escape capsule, Fred reported. He was 2, Kelly was 3. 3's pressure seal is compromised. We'll try to repair. But check for friendly beacons before you open fire on any escape capsules. Affirmative, Ascot said. And good luck. Only Linda had not reported. As he waited for her, John began to shoot wounded aliens. When he made his move to secure the commander's dead man's switch, the last thing he wanted was a still-capable elite ambushing him. By the time John had finished and reloaded both of his weapons, he still had not heard from Linda. It wasn't like her to disobey an order, but he glanced back down the grav tube just to be sure. Empty. Linda, what's the holdup?
Drones, Linda said. An entire nest, herding me like a damn sheep. They do not want me to leave.
John cursed himself. She would probably have been better off joining him on the bridge after all. What's your situation? He asked. I don't think I can wait much longer. I don't know whether this commander is dead or alive, but his hand could come off that dead man's switch any second.
Go, Linda said. I'm almost in the hangar. They can't stop me then.
Affirmative. John gathered himself to leap across the bridge, then thought, drones. They could fly. He stepped through the hatch and spun right, bringing his MA-5K up, and sure enough, saw a drone trying to track him with a plasma pistol. He brought it down with a quick burst, then spotted another on his motion tracker, dropping down behind him. He threw himself to the floor, rolled toward the commander's throne, and came around firing. The drone dropped to the deck in two pieces, and John rolled again, bringing a knee under and springing up, already stretching for the armrest. The throne spun away from him, whirling around in a three-quarter circle, the bloody hand still resting atop the yellow blister. John found himself looking over his shoulder into the pain-clouded eyes of the elite commander. The alien's head was cocked as though it could not quite understand what it was seeing, or could not quite bring itself to believe it. Its mandibles opened in a four-pointed star that might have been scorn, or laughter. Then it twisted its shoulders and dragged its hand free of the armrest. John did not wait to see the yellow blister rise. He dived for the nearest hatch and felt the ship rumble as he bounced off the edge and landed inside a spherical escape pod lined by crash couches and safety harnesses. He spun to his knees and lurched back toward the entrance, hands slapping at everything that could possibly be a control panel, and hoping Linda was clear of the hangar. The hatch closed, and in the next instant, he began to ricochet around the interior, his Mjolnir armor going into gel lock as the Covenant ship outside flew apart in a cloud of flame and metal, and his escape pod tumbled away.
Chapter 4 0840 Hours, March 7th, 2526, Military Calendar. UNSC Valiant Class Cruiser Everest. Deep Space Transitional Zone, Denizi System. The elevator made its first stop, and the doors opened to reveal a double-width passageway with a spotless deck and a recently painted overhead. The bulkheads were lined with life-size holographs of great naval commanders, dating all the way back to Themistocles and Lysander. Across from the elevator stood a pair of sentries, uniformed in service dress blues, and armed with MA-5B bullpup assault rifles. Staff Sergeant Avery Johnson stepped to the back of the car, making room for new riders, and assumed proper posture in case they happened to be officers. Which seemed likely, since the Navy did not post armed guards to secure access to crew decks. Even more telling was the sweet air beginning to drift in from the passageway. No ventilation chief wanted a bridge officer yelling at him about moldy ducts and musty scrubbers. But no one boarded. The sentries glanced toward Avery, but did not otherwise acknowledge his presence. The doors remained open, giving him time to study the holograph directly across from the elevator. Situated between the two sentries, it depicted a pointy-bearded Korean warrior in a conical helmet and knee-length hauberk. He didn't recognize the Korean's image from memory, but the information at the bottom read, Admiral Yi Sum-shin, who defeated a Japanese fleet of 133 ships with just 13 ships at the Myongyang Strait in 1597. Avery hoped the UNSC had a few admirals like Lee Sun-shin. The odds facing humanity right now were a lot worse than 10-1. After a moment, he realized the elevator had not stopped to admit new riders. He glanced over at the control panel and saw that he had arrived at level 19. The destination selected for him when he was ushered into the car. He hadn't noticed at the time, but levels 13 through 20 could only be accessed via biometric thumb scanner. Levels 1 through 12 could be reached by simple touchpad. There was another thumb scanner at the hangar deck level. Then the touchpads began again, increasing in number from first deck through 30 deck. Avery had been aboard enough large vessels to know this was standard ship layout. The hangar deck was always considered zero deck. Everything above the hangar was a level, rising from one to as high as necessary. Everything below the hangar deck was below decks, starting at first deck and descending through second deck, third deck, etc. What he did not know was why he had been sent to a command level of what seemed to be one of the largest vessels in the UNSC Navy. Just 3 minutes earlier, Avery had stumbled out of a transfer shuttle and descended the boarding ramp onto a hangar deck the size of a small city. Still groggy and shivering after a 3-week slipspace jump, he had been far from his usual handsome self. His black mustache had gone from close-trimmed to unkempt and spiky, while his brown skin had been dry and itchy. And waiting for him at the base of the ramp had been a burly lieutenant with a hangar boss insignia above her pocket. "Staff Sergeant, you look like something I just scraped off my boot heel." She was tall and broad-shouldered, with black lip gloss and blonde hair pulled into a bun. "Have you been drinking?"
"I wish, ma'am." Avery came to attention. "It's just cryofog. They pulled me out of a sleep tube about 5 minutes ago."
The lieutenant wrinkled her nose. "That explains the smell." She crooked a finger and turned away. "This way, Marine." Avery had followed her across 300 meters of deck to an elevator bank. She'd reached inside an open car and thumbed the control panel, then pointed him inside. "Welcome aboard, Sergeant Johnson." Avery had still been so foggy-headed that he had not thought to ask where he was going, or even what ship he was aboard. His original orders had called for him to join the 11th Marine Force Reconnaissance ODST Battalion at Neos Atlantis, then ship out to fight aliens in the outer colonies. But instead of awakening in orbit above the planet's familiar green ice ball, he had emerged from cryosleep to find himself aboard the UNSC transport schooner Santori, in the middle of a major battle fleet so far out in deep space he couldn't even tell which star was the local. His first assumption was that the 11th Recon had left Neos Atlantis early, and his transport had been diverted to join them in transit. Now he was beginning to wonder. When a Marine Staff Sergeant boarded a ship to join a combat unit, he wasn't usually received on a command level. Finally, the sentry on the left asked, "Something wrong, Sergeant Johnson?" "Possibly." Avery was a little surprised to be addressed by name, since he had not seen her gaze drop to the name tag on the breast of his combat utilities.
"Where am I?"
"The flag deck." An attractive petty officer second class, she had pale skin, hazel eyes, and short red hair, barely showing beneath her white and blue bucket cap. "You think we put on these dress blues just for you?"
"Never crossed my mind."
It was beginning to sound like Avery was in the right place after all. He stepped out of the elevator, then asked, "The flag deck of what vessel?" The sentry narrowed her eyes and glanced toward Avery's name tag, apparently confirming that he was who she thought he was, then said, "You're aboard the UNSC Super Heavy Cruiser Everest, flagship of Vice Admiral Preston J. Cole, Commander, Battle Group X-Ray.
Damn. Preston Cole had been a decent battle commander 20 years ago, before the Office of Naval Intelligence identified his second wife as an insurrectionist spy and forced him to retire. Over the next several years, the gossip vids had mentioned a couple of short marriages and bitter divorces, and Avery seemed to recall something about a long hospital stay for a double organ transplant. If Fleetcom was reactivating guys like him and giving them command of frontline battle groups, the UNSC was in worse trouble than Avery thought. He grunted, then asked, "And I'm here because?"
"I have no idea." The sentry looked him over from head to foot, then arched a brow.
"Only thing I can figure is there's more to you than meets the eye."
"On occasion." Avery wasn't sure whether she was flirting or putting him down, but he was a non-commissioned officer, and so was she, so he didn't see anything wrong with finding out. He grinned and added, "I could tell you about her over coffee." She almost smiled back.
"You'd have to shower first."
"I can do that." The second sentry, a smooth-faced petty officer third class with puffy cheeks and pale hair, cleared his throat. "Sergeant Johnson, the admirals aren't known for their patience." He extended a hand down the passageway. "It might be wise to arrange your date with Petty Officer Anagnos on your way out." Avery gave Anagnos an apologetic shrug, then glanced down the passageway past the holographs of a dozen ancient naval commanders. At the end, he saw a set of double doors. On the left-hand door was a large brass plaque that read Chester W. Nimitz. On the right-hand door was a plaque that read, "Secure Conference Suite."
"Son, did you say admirals, as in plural?"
"That's right, Sergeant."
Avery groaned. "I was afraid of that." Wondering what he'd done wrong this time, he picked up his duffel bag and started toward the doors. Along the way, he passed holographs of Marcus Agrippa, Oliver Hazard Perry, and Isoroku Yamamoto. Between the three of them, they had saved Rome at Actium, won control of Lake Erie during the War of 1812, and crippled the United States Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. With any luck, their ghosts would be among the admirals waiting in the Nimitz suite, because the way the war with the Covenant was going so far, Preston J. Cole would need all the help he could get. As Avery approached, the doors parted and slid aside. Beyond the threshold stood a young ensign in dress blues, his jaw set and his hands clasped behind his back. Avery stepped through the doorway into a rectangular compartment with a waiting area on one side and a galley on the other, then dropped his duffel bag next to his leg, came to attention, and saluted. "Staff Sergeant Avery Johnson reporting as—" He hesitated, realizing that he hadn't actually been ordered to report, then said, "As directed." The ensign returned his salute smartly, then reached for Avery's duffel. "Let me stow that for you, Sergeant. You won't be bunking here."
"Thank you, sir." Avery allowed the ensign to take the bag, then said, "My personal weapons are in the duffel, unloaded or sheathed."
"You're a squared-away Marine."
"May I offer you anything from the galley? Coffee or a sandwich?" Avery shook his head, then added, "Nothing, thank you. Unless you have some odor neutralizer handy. I'm coming straight from the cryo tube." The ensign, his nameplate read A. Tischler, gave a wry smile.
"I'd never have guessed."
He dropped the duffel behind a counter, then took a bottle of Rejuvirol from the beverage cooler.
"No worries. They knew what they were getting when they told Lieutenant Ruta to send you straight up."
"What's their hurry?" Avery asked. "Nobody's bothered to tell me what I'm doing here."
"I wish I knew, Sergeant."
Tischler pushed the bottle of Rejuvirol into Avery's hand, then stepped over to an interior door and pressed a thumb to a biometric scanner.
"No need for introductions. They already know who you are."
The door slid aside. Avery stepped through, then came to attention and brought his hand up in a salute. He found himself in a large compartment with a holographic star map at one end and a conference table at the other. On the far side of the table sat two gray-haired officers, with the triple stars of vice admirals on their collar tips. One was a haggard-faced man in his mid-50s, dressed in a white service uniform with no jacket, and the name P.J. Cole above his breast pocket. The other was a hollow-cheeked man in blue camouflage utilities with no unit patch, name tag, or service badges. A not-so-subtle hint that he was from Oni, and therefore not to be screwed with. Across from them sat a slender woman in a white lab coat. She had her back to Avery, so all he could tell about her was that she had collar-length chestnut hair, and was completely unintimidated by vice admirals. She was wagging a finger in their direction, pumping her arm up and down and lecturing the pair like schoolboys. "Can't defeat an enemy. It doesn't understand, Admiral," she said. "We must try again." "To what effect?" the Oni Admiral demanded. "You said yourself it might be a year before the Materials Group understands the alien technology." "Wars rarely end in a year." "This one might be an exception, Dr. Halsey." As Cole spoke, he flipped Avery a return salute, then pointed him toward the empty chair at the head of the conference table. "The UNSC has two choices at the moment. One, rotten, and the other, lousy. Either we engage the enemy right now and start losing fleets in battles we have no chance of winning, or we mass its strong points and let the enemy glass everything else." Glassing was a relatively new term to Avery, but one that had already grown much too familiar. It referred to the results of an alien plasma bombardment, which struck a planet's surface with so much heat that the silica in common dirt fused into glass. It seemed to be the Covenant's favorite method of reducing human worlds to uninhabitable wastelands. "I should think the answer is obvious," Halsey said. "We mass at the strong points. It will take the Covenant at least 2 years to locate all of our undefended worlds. And by then the Materials Group will have reverse-engineered Catherine." "FleetCom can't do that," said the Oni Admiral. He was referring to Fleet Command, which oversaw the deployment and combat operations of the entire UNSC Space Navy. "We'd be leaving hundreds of worlds defenseless. We'd be condemning billions of colonists to death by plasma incineration. And if you commit prematurely, you will lose every fleet you send, and leave hundreds of worlds defenseless anyway." The woman paused and watched Avery ease himself into the chair Cole had indicated, then looked back to the Oni Admiral. "I think you need to make FleetCom understand that, Admiral Stanforth. There is nothing you can do to save those people. Not until I can give you the tools you need to fight." In his chair at the head of the table, Avery sat ramrod straight and wondered what the hell he was doing there. He'd never heard of the Materials Group, or Dr. Catherine Halsey, or Oni Vice Admiral Stanforth, which, in the tradition of clandestine services everywhere, probably meant he didn't want to. Even more confusing, both admirals were talking to Halsey as though she had equal say in their decisions. Which didn't make any sense. Now that Avery was sitting adjacent to her, he could see that Halsey wasn't even military. Beneath the lab coat, she was wearing a form-fitting jumpsuit that had more in common with a laboratory clean suit than a uniform, and in her piercing blue eyes there was a stubbornness that would have been disciplined out of her the first week of boot camp. After a moment, Cole leaned forward and braced his forearms on the table. "Point taken, Dr. Halsey," he said. "But if FleetCom decided to pursue your plan..." Avery snorted at the absurdity. He was so shocked it just came out, then swallowed hard as three heads swiveled in his direction. "Pardon me." He opened the rejuverol he had been given by Ensign Tischler. "Something just went down the wrong pipe." Stanforth smirked. Cole merely frowned and looked back across the table, leaving Avery to wonder if the reactivated admiral's instincts could really be so rusty that he would consider Halsey's plan. The minute the UNSC began to abandon planets and mass its strongpoint worlds, the outer colonies would go into full rebellion, and the UNSC would have two wars on its hands, not to mention billions of dead civilians. No commander could accept that kind of casualty figure. But Cole seemed determined to entertain the idea. "If we could persuade FleetCom to pursue your plan, Dr. Halsey, how can we be sure the aliens will go after undefended targets first? Why not destroy our strong points, then locate and eliminate the defenseless worlds at their leisure? That's hardly an efficient invasion strategy, Halsey said. The most effective way to advance is shock penetration. Bypass strong points to secure easy victories and seize enemy territory. Then bring up heavier units to reduce the strong points in a more measured fashion. That's been optimum infiltration strategy since Oscar von Hutier used it in Operation Michael in 1918.
But have the aliens studied Operation Michael? Cole asked. More importantly, could they know a better way? Stanforth nodded.
Technology dictates strategy, he said, and since we don't understand their technology, we can't anticipate their strategy. I see that.
Halsey was quiet for a minute, then said, and it's all the more reason to attempt another ship capture.
Ship capture. Avery had a sinking feeling he'd just heard the real reason he was here. Earlier that year, he'd actually boarded a Covenant vessel near the planet Harvest, then ended up fighting a protracted surface battle against a company of alien warriors. There were probably only a handful of Marines in the UNSC who could say the same thing, and that made Avery a pretty good choice to lead a suicidal boarding action. But Stanforth vehemently shook his head.
Another capture attempt is too risky, he said. It keeps the assault squad aboard too long. We're lucky we didn't lose our Spartans at Netherop.
It wasn't luck, Admiral, Halsey said. It was training and capability. And the mission was not a total failure. I've already ascertained a great deal from the captured Banshees. We're still learning how to operate them. But I can tell you that, despite the lack of instrumentality and the enigmatic architecture, the drives and even the weaponry don't seem as effective.
Yes, that's great, Cole interrupted. But is it going to help us this year?
Halsey hesitated, then said, It's a mistake to focus on the short term, Admiral.
The short term is all we have. Cole sank back in his seat, and his tone grew firm.
Dr. Halsey, I'll get you an alien ship if the chance presents itself, but capture can't be our prime objective. We lost 13 vessels taking Harvest back. Against one Covenant defender. If we don't blunt the Covenant advance, the outer colonies will be so many glass marbles by this time next year.
I'm afraid I agree, Catherine, Stanforth said.
It's the only way to buy the time your group needs to give us a fighting chance.
Halsey sighed, then reluctantly nodded.
I'll support the operation however I can, naturally.
She turned to Cole.
I look forward to hearing your plan.
So do I.
Cole's gaze slid toward Avery.
As soon as we develop one.
Avery's stomach clenched. He hadn't even heard that the UNSC had counterattacked at Harvest, much less what it had cost them.
You're asking me for input, sir? You see anyone else in this compartment who looks like he's been trading fire with aliens on a regular basis?
Avery glanced around the table for form's sake, then said, No, sir.
Then now's the time to speak up, Sergeant, Stanforth said. I didn't forge those transfer orders so you could sit on your hands. Tell us what you think.
Avery hesitated a moment, trying to decide whether turning to a non-com for advice made the two admirals smart or desperate. In either case, he had to answer, and not only because he was being ordered to. Unless he spoke up, he would never be able to complain about a commander's stupid battle plan again.
All right, sir. What strikes me first is that while the enemy's technology is very superior to ours, their soldiers aren't.
Elaborate on that, Cole said.
I assume you've all read the incident reports from the initial contact at Harvest.
Stanforth nodded.
Then think about what happened there, Avery said. Sergeant Byrne and I killed 5 Jackal Raiders, then fought our way aboard their ship. The only reason we didn't take it is because their captain self-destructed it to avoid capture. Later we fought off a company of brutes and grunts at the Harvest Botanical Gardens with a platoon of half-trained militia, and over the next few weeks we managed to evacuate the planet right under their noses. So the Covenant may have better equipment, but from what I've seen, they're inferior soldiers.
Interesting, Stanforth said. And your impressions of the different species?
The brutes are ferocious, Avery said, but not as clever as they think they are.
I'm sorry.
Brutes, Cole asked. The big ape-looking ones, Avery said. They seem to like hand-to-hand combat, where their strength is an advantage. The jackals are cunning, but not very brave. The buggers...
Buggers?
Stanforth asked.
I believe he means what John is calling the drones.
Halsey turned to Avery. Those flying insectoids?
Sounds right, Avery said.
Whatever we call them. They're unrelenting, but easy to misdirect. And the grunts? Well, the grunts are mostly dangerous because they get in your way.
What about the tall saurians? Cole asked.
Those are the ones that worry me.
I don't believe Sergeant Johnson fought any of them on Harvest, Stanford said.
He turned to Avery. They're some kind of leader class, larger and stronger than the jackals. They might be comparable to our orbital drop shock troopers, smart, tough, and disciplined.
In other words, the ones we kill first, Avery said.
Stanforth smiled, then looked to Cole.
I like him.
He's confident, Cole replied. That's good.
Avery was there for more than a debrief, he realized. He was being tested for an assignment he might not want.
With all due respect, he said, if there's something I should know, and observant, too,
Halsey interrupted, you could do worse.
Worse than what? Avery asked. What exactly are we talking about here?
Relax, Stanforth said. We don't really know yet ourselves.
But they want a veteran on the team who's actually fought the Covenant, Halsey said. And there aren't many of you available. The Covenant is very thorough that way.
What team? Avery demanded.
At ease, Sergeant. This time Stanforth's words were in order. So far, it's just a planning team.
Avery relaxed.
A little. But I don't know naval tactics, sir, he said. I'm an infantry marine.
You were also an Orion Project volunteer, Halsey said, which makes you an ideal addition for this assignment.
Orion Project? Avery repeated. That had been a top-secret naval special warfare program to create biologically augmented super soldiers to fight the insurrection. As a participant, Avery had acquired his orbital drop rating and developed top-notch sniper and close combat skills. But the program had been shut down almost 20 years earlier, when its results failed to justify the cost.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
As one, Stanforth rolled his eyes, Cole looked annoyed, and Halsey pursed her lips.
Okay. Maybe I've heard of it, Avery said. Even that was more than he was supposed to admit under the Orion Project's ultra-classified protocols. But he was beginning to think that of all the people sitting at the table, he was the one who knew the least about the Orion Project.
What's the assignment?
You keep asking that, Stanford said, and I'm telling you we still don't know. Really.
Sorry, sir, Avery said. I'm a little confused.
I'll try to clear that up, Cole said.
The Covenant ships are protected by energy shielding that nothing short of a nuke or a mass accelerator cannon can penetrate in one shot. Since their vessels are faster and more maneuverable than ours, that's a problem.
Because you never get more than one shot, Avery surmised.
Sometimes not even one, Cole said. To make matters worse, their plasma beams cut through our titanium A armor like it's paper.
And their pulse lasers are damn near as bad, Stanforth said. So we're trying to find a way to fight that doesn't involve fleet-to-fleet engagements.
Given your special operations background, Sergeant, Halsey said, and your creativity in improvising under the Harvest evacuation, I thought you might be an asset.
Avery nodded.
I can definitely bring some asymmetric whoop-ass to your game, he said. Mines, decoys, logistics, sabotage, provision poisoning, false signals. Just give me a couple of prowlers and 50 good ODSTs.
All good ideas, Cole said, and we're already implementing most of them.
We want to add you to something that's a bit more hard-hitting, Stanford said. Something with the potential to rock the enemy back on their heels. Avery didn't like it when officers said potential. That meant they were gambling big. And when officers gambled big, jarheads died.
Okay, I'm listening.
As you've noted yourself, the aliens themselves aren't as good as their technology, Stanford said. We have a special unit that's taken advantage of that to board a couple of enemy vessels.
The capture attempt you were discussing when I arrived, Avery said. The failed capture attempt.
The vessel was still destroyed, Stanford said, as was a frigate-sized ship the first time the team tried this.
It's our single most effective tactic from all that we've seen, Cole added. We'd like to try it on something bigger.
How big?
As big as we can find, Stanford said. Don't worry, Cole flashed a grin. You'll have nukes. Avery was not amused. So far, Cole struck him as an admiral who would probably been a pretty good commander in his day, but hardly someone special enough to drag out of retirement.
Nukes are fun, Avery finally said, but I haven't volunteered for anything yet.
You will, Stanford said. You always do.
After 20 years, Avery said, maybe it's time I learned my lesson.
Sir, not yet.
Stanford leaned in and locked eyes with Avery. You don't want to miss this one, Johnson. You'll be part of a team that's going to save the human race. And I'm not exaggerating.
Avery grunted and wished he had a cigar right now. He always thought better when he was chewing on a sweet William.
After a moment, Avery said, something as big as you're thinking will be protected by a fleet. We can't just rush in and drop a boarding party.
That's why we want your experience on this operation, Cole said.
And your creativity, Halsey added. I imagine you'll need to develop new infiltration tactics for each mission.
Each mission? Avery echoed. You intend to do this more than once?
Certainly, Halsey said. You don't expect to stop the Covenant by destroying one ship, do you?
Well, I suppose not.
Without being aware of it, Avery pulled the Sweet William from his breast pocket and jammed it, unlit, between his teeth.
What's our force?
The primary force will be an ODST Space Assault Battalion, Cole said. The 21st.
Avery smiled. Colonel Crowther's Black Daggers, he said. That's a good unit.
The best, Stanford said. But you'll be attached to a special squad of 12 Spartans.
Spartans?
Avery chomped his cigar. He had heard Stanford use the term earlier, but he'd assumed that a Spartan was a designation for a new kind of special operations soldier. Now it was beginning to sound more like a unit, or maybe some sort of advanced infiltration craft.
What exactly is a Spartan?
Show him, Catherine. Stanford glanced toward Avery. Your security clearance just rose 3 levels, Sergeant.
Avery nodded, and Halsey withdrew a portable holopad from the pocket of her lab coat.
She placed it on the table in front of Avery, then touched the activation tab. The meter-tall hologram of a heavily armored form appeared above the pad. With a blocky helmet, mirrored faceplate, and bulky outer shell, the figure looked more like a robot than a man. Had there been integrated cannons to add firepower and a few extra limbs to facilitate movement, Avery would have assumed he was looking at a prototype war android. But the Spartan had only 2 legs, 2 arms, and a single helmet with a forward-looking faceplate, so there had to be a human inside.
Impressive, Avery said.
There were no other figures in the hologram to provide scale, but judging by the size of the MA-5K assault carbine affixed to the magnetic mount on the back of the armor, the Spartan had to be well over 2 meters tall.
But it's going to take more than 12 soldiers in fancy armor to do the job you're talking about.
The Mjolnir power armor is the least of their assets, Sergeant Johnson. Halsey's voice was proud. The Spartan II program succeeded where the Orion project failed. They are what you were meant to be.
This old failure has been getting the job done for 2 decades. Avery didn't appreciate being called a dud, but at least he was beginning to understand why the admirals treated Halsey with such deference. But go ahead and brief me anyway.
No need to take offense, Sergeant Johnson. The Orion Project failed you.
Halsey left the hologram of the Spartan standing in the middle of the table. Each Spartan was selected at a young age for intelligence, physical prowess, aggressiveness, and emotional resilience. They were almost literally born to be soldiers. After conscription, they trained for 8 years to become the most elite warriors humanity has ever seen. So why am I only hearing about them now? Ideally, they wouldn't have been fully deployed for another 2 years, Halsey said. But when the Covenant appeared, we had to accelerate the program.
So you were going to train them for a decade? Avery asked. Talk about overkill.
Not for what we intended, Halsey said. The extra time would have given me an opportunity to fine-tune their biological augmentations and develop some custom enhancements. But no matter. My Spartans are still stronger, faster, more resilient, and more capable than any soldier you have ever seen.
I don't doubt it, Avery said, remembering the long course of biochemical enhancement injections he had endured during the Orion Project. It had been an agonizing experience filled with confused, hormone-induced rages, and given the apparent size of the Spartan in the hologram, he could only marvel at the anguish the man must have endured during his own augmentation process. But if these Spartans of yours are so great, why do you need me?
First, you have some understanding of what they've been through, Halsey said. Second, you have something they don't. 20 years of combat experience.
Exactly, Stanforth said. These kids are top-notch soldiers, but they're still 15.
15, Avery said. Doesn't that make them they are not children, Stanforth interrupted.
Get that notion out of your head, Sergeant. Do I make myself clear?
Avery swallowed.
Yes, sir. He had done enough work for Oney to understand that the Admiral was telling him not to ask questions that the Office of Naval Intelligence didn't want answered.
I only meant to inquire about their, level of training.
Second to none, Halsey said. They entered boot camp at age 6 and earned every combat rating by age 8.
You might say they attended an elite military academy, Stanforth said. Not so different from Corbulo Academy or Luna OCS.
Halsey grimaced and looked away.
Yes. You might say a lot of things, she complained. That doesn't make the Martian Elementary Education Complex the equal of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics.
My apologies, Catherine. Stanforth looked more amused than regretful. He turned back to Avery.
The important thing is that on paper, the Spartans are every bit the soldier you are. They just need someone who understands the intangibles that can't be taught on a training mission. Someone who has a few tricks up his sleeve.
In other words, a sergeant, Avery said.
Exactly, Stanforth said. Just not a sergeant who gives orders.
Avery scowled. Are you looking for a sergeant or a nanny?
More of a big brother, Stanforth said. They already have a squad leader they trust, and you'd never replace him.
He understands their capabilities in a way you never will, Halsey added. They've been training together so long their communication seems almost telepathic at times.
Avery gnawed on his cigar and wondered if he dared say no. The last thing he wanted was to play babysitter for a squad of new boots. But he wasn't aware of any admiral who appreciated being told no. And Oney admirals did not play nice. If he turned down this assignment, he had a feeling his next one would be guarding snowballs on Venus. Finally, Avery sighed.
If I'm that important to the operation, how can I refuse?
Exactly. Stanforth flashed a tight-lipped smile. You can't.
Chapter 5. 0558 hours. March 8th, 2526. Military calendar. UNSC Point Blank Class Stealth Cruiser Vanishing Point. Deep Space, Polona Sector. Even on a vessel as large as the UNSC Stealth Cruiser Vanishing Point, John 117 was too tall to stand upright inside the Tactical Planning Center. He must have been an astonishing sight, because as he followed Dr. Catherine Halsey toward the conference table, all eyes swung toward him and remained fixed there. He was wearing his khaki service uniform rather than his Mjolnir armor, but in cramped spaces like the TPC, standard clothing only seemed to emphasize his size. Dr. Halsey took the first open chair, but John stopped two steps from the table and drew himself into a hunched-over version of attention. There was more brass in the compartment than he usually saw in a month, with Vice Admiral Preston Cole standing at the far end of the table between Halima Ascot and a Marine colonel John didn't recognize. Seated at the table, three chairs from the end, was a grim-faced staff sergeant with dark skin and a short-trimmed mustache. He was pretty old. About 40, John guessed, with crow's feet around his eyes and permanent frown lines flanking his mouth. The colonel wore the flaming skull ODST crest on the breast of his combat utilities, and the black dagger emblem of the 21st Space Assault Battalion on his shoulder. The sergeant wore no unit emblem at all, an indication that he either had just transferred into the battalion or was attached to an ONI Black Ops unit. Cole returned John's salute. "Have a seat, Petty Officer." He pointed to a chair next to the one Dr. Halsey had selected. "No need to kink that thick neck of yours." "Thank you, sir." John slipped into the indicated chair and found himself directly across from the mustached staff sergeant. Above the breast pocket, the sergeant wore a name label that read A. Johnson, but John knew better than to assume it was the man's real name. It was exactly the kind of generic alias ONI might assign to an operator it didn't want to acknowledge. Whatever his real name, the sergeant studied John with an air of unabashed appraisal, as though he couldn't quite decide whether John was a real soldier or just some oversized pretender. John didn't take offense. With clear blue eyes and thin brown eyebrows set in an oval face, John still looked like a teenager, and he knew that made him appear less capable than he was. Cole waited until Ascot and the Marine colonel had taken their seats, then nodded toward a control booth in the back of the compartment. "That's everyone." The TPC's door slid shut, then a hush settled over the compartment, and all eyes turned toward the Admiral. Well, almost all eyes. Johnson continued to study John. "Let's start with the obvious," Cole said. "We're holding this briefing aboard the Vanishing Point rather than my flagship for operational security. There are a lot of clever people aboard the Everest, and if they saw this group reporting to my conference suite, tongues would start wagging." John looked around the table and realized Cole was right. The captain of a prowler squadron, the commander of a space assault battalion, a veteran black ops sergeant. Even before he considered himself and Dr. Halsey, it seemed obvious to him that a force was being assembled to board another Covenant vessel. Probably a big one. "Now, introductions." Cole gestured to Ascot. "Captain Halima Ascot, commander of Task Force Yama." Ascot's eyes widened at the statement, a sign that the possibility had still been under discussion when John and Dr. Halsey entered the room. Recovering quickly, she tucked a lock of short blonde hair behind an ear, then turned her gray eyes on the others. "At this point, I don't know much more than you do," she said. "All I can add is that Task Force Yama will be an all-prowler force, consisting of three squadrons of Eclipse and Razor-class prowlers, each led by a Sahara-class prowler. The Vanishing Point will serve as our logistics support ship." John frowned. Three squadrons was overkill for a capture mission, even if they were prowlers. Stealthy or not, that many vessels would raise the boarding party's chances of being spotted as it moved into position. Cole extended a hand toward the Marine colonel. "Colonel Marmon Crowther, commander of the 21st Black Dagger Space Assault Battalion." "Thank you, Admiral." A short and slender man of about 50, Crowther had black hair, olive skin, and eyes the color of blued steel. The Black Daggers consist of 800 elite orbital dropshot troopers, trained and equipped for zero-G operations. We have yet to engage the Covenant, but last year alone we stormed and seized 18 insurrectionist facilities in the